the fundamental charge, G, are given by QA. So in other words, if what I mean by this is for an electron under QED, Q would be minus one. For an up quark, it'd be plus two-thirds, et cetera. So I've allowed all the fermions to have distinct charges. And similarly, if I have complex scalars, I allow them to have distinct charges, and there could be n sub phi of these. And I can, so I have here a gauge theory with described by a Lie group with n equals one generators, and that I'll call the electromagnetic field, or generally a U1 field. It doesn't have to be electromagnetism. And the representation matrix for the fermion fields is reducible, and it's just a diagonal matrix with the elements are the charges, and similarly for the complex scalar fields. So I have allowed for a reducible representation here. They each just transform with their own charge. Under a gauge transformation, the ordinary derivatives of the fields are transforming in a complicated way, because the ordinary derivative, you cannot simply pull through an e to the I beta through an ordinary derivative, because the derivative of psi involves a derivative of beta as well as a term derivative of psi. However, the gauge covariant derivative is such that the d mu, if I replace psi by psi prime and a by a prime, then the e to the I beta, and there should be an L psi here. The these pull through the gauge covariant derivative, because the derivative acting on the e to the I beta term compensates the shift in the A. So you can write down automatically a gauge invariant Lagrangian. For example, L equals psi bar I d slash psi. Maybe I'll even be pedantic and write a psi and phi here just to indicate that these are the gauge covariant derivatives defined for the fermion fields with its matrix and for the complex scalars. So this is clearly invariant under a gauge transformation. And similarly, I haven't written these before, but d mu phi dagger d mu phi is the gauge covariant kinetic energy term for the scalars. That's invariant. And minus a quarter f mu nu, where f mu nu is the field strength tensor, is gauge invariant. So this Lagrangian is gauge invariant. And to have a local or gauge invariant U1 symmetry, it was necessary to introduce a gauge field. It has to be massless, at least in the absence of the Higgs mechanism, because any term m squared over 2 ma squared over 2 a squared would be violate the gauge invariant, so that's not allowed. So gauge invariant requires the existence of the apparently massless spin 1 field, and it dictates the form of the interaction buried in these kinetic energy terms. You are also free to add terms such as mass terms for the psi's, or mass terms for the phi's, or interactions that couple the psi's to the phi's, or self-interactions of the phi's, as long as they're globally invariant. All of those things don't involve derivatives, so any extra terms, interactions, or mass terms, if they're consistent with the global U1, if conserving charge, they'll also be automatically gauge invariant. Yes.
What would go wrong if we just tried to write down a theory of E and M that's not gauge, like that's not a gauge theory?
Yeah. What's wrong? Nothing's wrong with it. as I said a couple times, we're not doing an axiomatic mathematics here. We're trying to describe nature as we see it. And it took, with the elementary particles, it took about 50 years to sort of ascertain by combinations of trying everything possible and experiment and seeing what was there. It was found that the gauge theories describe the known strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions. So we're starting from that starting point. But you can certainly write down non-gauge theories. It is true, however, that gauge theories are the only renormalizable field theories involving the spin one particles. So if you want renormalizability and you want spin one, you're pretty much stuck with gauge theories. And unlike a global symmetry, gauge symmetries you don't want to explicitly break, because the advantage is that they're renormalizable. But if you put even a tiny explicit breaking of the gauge invariance into your Lagrangian, that messes up the renormalizability and you get uncontrollable divergences. Okay, so that was the U1 case. Now for a non-abelian gauge theory, that is basically everything will be the same, except now I have to have a set of fields. So just as in the case of global symmetries, I'm going to introduce a set of fields, phi, which can be spin a half or spin zero, I don't care. And I'm going to assume that they are in, that there are n of these, little n. And in this case, I'm just going to focus on one irreducible representation. There, basically, I wrote it in this form to show that you can have each of those fields by themselves was an irreducible representation, one-dimensional. But one can put them together to have a larger theory. Similarly, I'm going to focus here on one irreducible representation of the group. But of course, you can have lots of irreducible representations floating around simultaneously. And so this could be spin a half or spin zero. And the gauge transformation is that phi goes into e to the I beta of x dot L phi, where L equals L1 through L capital N. So I have capital N generators. And the L sub I is a little n dimensional irreducible representation of the Lie algebra. And the phi is a column vector. So this is the gauge transformation acting on phi. And I will often write this as U of beta of x phi. Now, under an ordinary derivative, acting on phi, of course, has the same problem that we had before. The ordinary derivative acting on phi has two terms. One is u d mu beta, d mu of phi. And then there's a second term, d mu of u phi. So if I tried to write a Lagrangian just involving ordinary derivatives, once again, it would not be gauge invariant because there'd be these extra pieces when I replace phi by phi prime. This is d mu phi prime. So d mu phi is replaced by d mu phi prime, which is not just u d mu phi, but has this extra piece in it. So if I tried to write down a Lagrangian just involving the ordinary derivatives, it would not be invariant. However, I can again introduce a gauge covariant derivative, which is the ordinary derivative. And anytime I write ordinary derivative, it's implicit that it's multiplying the identity matrix. Plus I G A mu dot L. And A mu is A 1 mu through A n mu. I have to introduce one vector field, one gauge field per generator. And there's only one gauge coupling. That's assuming it's a simple group like SU3 or SU4. If it's a direct product, group, then the individual factors can have different gauge couplings. I have to specify how the fields transform, how the vector fields transform. And I will simply write it down without going into great detail about it. But what I want to do is I want to specify a field transformation such that d mu of phi goes to d prime mu, that is the d constructed out of d a prime, phi prime. And we want this to be just u times d mu phi, just as in the abelian case. That's what we want. And in order to do this, well, by now we have the experience, we realize that A transforms something like this. A is going to transform, I'm going to assign A to transform as the adjoint representation of the group. And we know something about, for a global symmetry, how A mu dot L for any adjoint transforms. Namely, I'm going to specify that A mu dot L is going to go into A prime mu. Well, I can put the mu up here to be consistent, dot L. And this is going to have two pieces. This first piece is exactly the way I would have had any adjoint field transform under a global transformation. And the global transformation is a special case in which I take beta to be constant. That's a special case of the gauge transformation. So this is going to ensure that under the global part of the transformation, everything works properly. And then I have to have another term. Which is derivative of u times u inverse times I over g. And that looks vaguely like the second term, like the gauge transformation for the u1 case. In the u1 case, the adjoint representation is trivial. There was only one generator. So in fact, in the u1 case, the A field was a singlet under the global transformation, but it has this shift associated with the derivative of beta. Here we have two pieces, and now the adjoint, the A is not a singlet, it's non-trivial, and it has the piece that would be there even for the global transformation, plus a piece involving derivative. And to make this a little more concrete, if I just work to lowest order in beta, A prime I mu, I'll put the mu downstairs to make it look cleaner, is AI mu minus CIJK beta J A mu k minus 1 over g d mu beta I plus order beta squared. So the lowest order, we have a piece that would be there for any global transformation plus the piece involving the shift, which is familiar from electrodynamics. This form indeed leads to this. I won't go through it. It's just plug this in along with the transformation for the phi up there. Phi goes to phi prime equals u phi, and this is just one line. You can probably do it in your head, but if not, just work it out. That's trivial. So in fact, we have now this result. And in terms of the gauge covariant derivative, I can write an invariant Lagrangian. And the invariant Lagrangian is, well, let me just write a general one out. So if a Lagrangian would be for fermion psi bar I d psi slash psi. And this simply means that I'm using whatever representation matrix is appropriate for the fermions here. If I also have complex scalars, you can also, well, let me just say, if I have complex scalars, I can write a kinetic energy term for the complex scalars. And if I had just an ordinary derivative here, that is the kinetic energy for a complex scalar without gauge invariance. And so I have just promoted it to a gauge transformation. And then I have to write a kinetic energy term for the capital N gauge fields, or I could write it F here. And Fi mu nu is equal to d mu a I nu minus d nu a mu I minus g c I j k a mu j a nu k. So the field strength tensor for the ith gauge field is the familiar one that's just the kinetic energy, but it gets modified also. And this is actually the term that's basically would come from promoting those derivatives to gauge covariant derivatives for the gauge fields. So one introduces an extra term here as well. And this is a function of the fact that the gauge fields are no longer singlets under global transformations. The CIJK is non-zero. The U1, the CIJK is zero. So this means there will be self-interactions of the fields when you square this. Now, it's not as obvious that this is gauge invariant as this. And I don't want to go through the exercise. I could actually write this F by going to some F dot L, just as I did for the gauge fields, and I could write this term in terms of these matrices fairly easily, and it becomes very easy to show that this is invariant under the global transformations. It's a little more messier to show that the gauge part of the transformation is invariant, but it is. So this is the general form for a non-abelian gauge invariant theory involving fermions and complex scalars transforming under their own irreducible representations of the gauge group. And again, one has to introduce spin one fields, one per generator. The form of the interactions is embedded in these terms and in these terms. So all of the interactions are specified, are determined once you know what the representations are, and once you know this one number, G, the gauge coupling. Of course, you can have different gauge groups, different representations. You can have more than one irreducible representation for each. So there is still a lot of freedom. But basically, the gauge invariance restricts a lot of things. Are there any questions so far? Yes. Yes. The Lagrangian on the top was just, this is the same as this, specialized to the case n equals 1, the U1 case, except for the fact that I allowed an reducible representation for the matter field.
What I was saying is, since the Lagrangian on top doesn't have mass terms,
yeah,
it actually still has a global symmetry with the non-abelian, right? I could always go.
No, well, yes, there is, that's correct, but what I stated was that I was only writing the gauge parts, so technically what you're saying is true, but it's implicit that you can add whatever mass terms, and it's true here too, you can also add mass terms and things like psi bar, you know, interactions like this, et cetera. Anything that is globally invariant can also be added as long as it doesn't have derivatives, and that's implicit here. But you're right, if you don't have any of that, then they're generally, if you just start with the Lagrangian at the top, you would have a UN psi cross UN psi cross UN phi cross UN phi global non-abelian Weber symmetry. But mass terms generally will break that down as well to lower symmetries. Anything else? Now let me just write these terms out a little bit more explicitly. So this we know is psi bar, and then it becomes I d slash, and it's implicitly a identity matrix here, minus g a slash dot l psi. And this term, well, this term can be rewritten in a, let me write it out. So this is d mu phi plus, I always, I g a, I'm missing, yeah, a mu dot l phi. The whole thing dagger. Well, I'm sorry, this is acting on phi, the whole thing daggered. And then here we have d mu, it's just d, yeah, plus I g a mu dot l phi phi. So you see that, and I won't write that out any further. The point I'm trying to make here is that this interaction term for the phis will involve two types of terms. Well, it's got its ordinary kinetic energy. Then there will be terms involving one derivative, say this acting on phi, and then an A dot L acting on phi. So that will give some sort of three-point vertex, A, phi, phi, and I'll specify that more later. And then there will also be a term that involves A squared and phi squared. And these are known as seagulls. I didn't write all this stuff down for the abelian case, but I could have. Okay, and it's convenient to, I think I'll just leave it at that and go to the Feynman rules. So, so again, one can add any mass terms or interaction terms that are non-derivative and consistent with the gauge, with the global symmetry. I can write scalar self-interactions if they're consistent with the global symmetry. I can, for the fermions, I can generalize to a chiral symmetry in which the left and right-handed psis transform differently. And but what I cannot do is I cannot add any term mi squared over 2 a mu I, because this would violate the gauge invariance. Okay, let me write down the Feynman rules or some of the Feynman rules that you get from this. First of all, if you have a fermion B goes to fermion A, absorbing or emitting gauge boson I with Lorentz index mu, and the AI mus are Hermitian in this basis, so the rule doesn't really care whether it's coming in or going out of the vertex. If I want this really to be a final, well, the rule is that this is just minus I G gamma mu L psi I the AB component. The Feynman rule is basically the corresponding term in the Lagrangian times I. So it's minus IG times the, there's a gamma mu hidden in the slash, and there's an L psi IAB here. Then when this is part of a diagram, you either put U or V spinners, a U bar or V var, a U or a V. If this is a final or initial gauge boson, you put an epsilon or an epsilon star. If these are internal lines, you put appropriate propagators. If the symmetry is chiral, that can be generalized to a chiral symmetry simply by writing that L is equal to some piece Li times P left plus some piece I'll call Li right, P right, where again P left or P right is 1 minus or plus gamma phi over 2. These terms would project out left or right chiral fermions in the vertex. And in general, if I have different representations, for example, if L is fundamental and L right is the ident is zero, so that it's a singlet, that would be an example of a chiral transformation. And this goes if these are equal, and I'm going to stop writing the psi now. This would just go into Li if they're equal, but they could be different. So in a chiral transformation, you'll have not only a gamma mu, but you have the Dirac indices that come in here. Again, there are three spaces of indices here simultaneously. There's the I, which runs over the capital N gauge bosons. There's four spaces. There's the A and B, which run over the elements of the fermion or scalar representation. There's mu, which is the Lorentz index. And there are Dirac indices embedded in the gamma matrices. So you've got four spaces of indices going on simultaneously here. A three-point vertex for A, for B goes, scalar B goes to scalar A, and this is I mu. And here, suppose PA, PB, and PA are the momenta that are carried by those particles. So I'm going to write it for the moment for an initial particle, B, with four momentum PB, final particle A, four momentum PA. This one is just minus IG PA plus PB mu LI phi AB. So here you have momenta, sum of the momenta, and that comes from the cross terms. Those are the derivatives acting on phi, which when you go to momentum space become four momenta. If you twist it around so that, for example, you had A coming in and B, anti-B coming in, then it's a similar rule, except you get a minus sign in front of the PB. Anytime that you've got the antiparticle involved, there's a minus sign in that vertex. The seagull is a four-point vertex, two gauge bosons. And this is I G squared L I phi L J phi plus L J phi L I phi the A B component. So it's just a product of two matrices. It's really the anti-commutator of the matrices, and you can basically see that from the square of this term. And the sign comes about from the fact that it's minus I because of the adjoint here and plus I. So that's one, and then there's an extra I. It's I times the Lagrangian, so that's the factor. Yes, thank you very much. There's a G mu. There are 3 and 4 point vertices. That are rather messy. If this is I mu J nu K sigma are the group and Lorentz indices for three particles, and P, Q, and R are the four momenta, and I'm going to always define for these rules the four momenta as going into the vertex. So if it's a physical particle going out, then P is minus its physical four momentum. And this one is G, C, I, J, K, G mu nu times Q minus P sigma plus three other terms, or two other terms. I'm not going to write it all out, it's too tedious. But there's three more terms like this that involve permutations of indices. And I put a table with all this stuff on that website. Finally, there's a four-point vertex. And I'm not even going to write the labels here because I'm not going to write all the terms. I'll just write a typical term, minus I G squared C I J M C K L M. M is a dummy variable that's summed over, and I, J, K, and L involve the four external lines. And then there's a G mu sigma, G nu rho. These are the Lorentz indices of the external lines, plus five more terms. So there are six terms, all of this sort of complicated structure. And again, if you want to see them in detail, they're on that chart that I put on the website. It's not instructive to write it out here. And you can see that actually doing Feynman diagrams involving vertices like this is very complicated. And so rarely does anybody do any such diagrams by hand. If you're forced to do them, I've done some by hand, and it's a real mess, even when you use all kinds of tricks to simplify. There are computer programs that can do this. And for example, there's a set of Mathematica add-ons that you can use to do diagrams involving all this stuff. Finally, a propagator. If you have just a propagator, here's momentum Q, and the indices here are J, I, mu, nu, then the propagator is minus I, G, mu, nu, Kronecker delta, I, J over Q squared. This is the so-called unitary gauge form of the propagator that you need to do for a Feynman diagram. And for a fermion or scalar within the Feynman propagator, the group index is conserved. Now, of course, I think you saw something about gauge boson propagators in field theory courses, even for U1. To talk about a general gauge is very complicated. And when one adds the Higgs mechanism, which I haven't done yet, it's the general form of the gauge propagators is a very, very complex subject. But for simple tree-level purposes, it usually suffices just to use this. And this is an obvious generalization of the photon propagator, in which you just don't have that factor. Okay, are there any questions? Okay, that's all I'm going to do in the abstract on the non-abelian gauge theories until I get to the electroweak standard model, and at that point I will introduce the Higgs mechanism, which is a mechanism for actually generating mass for gauge bosons without messing up the renormalizability. But for now, I'm assuming unbroken, no spontaneous breaking, no Higgs mechanism, and that the gauge bosons are massless. Any questions? Okay, as the first major example, I'm going to turn to quantum chromodynamics, or QCD. Thank you. So for decades, physicists struggled with trying to find a quantitative, calculable description of the strong interactions, first using Lagrangian field theories for pions and nucleons and rows and so forth. They were not very successful because the couplings were strong. People tried things that were not even field theory, just things called the S-matrix theory that was involved general consistency conditions, trying to postulating that there was a unique set of scattering amplitudes for strongly interacting particles without an underlying field theory. But finally, in the 1960s, the combination of the quark model and non-abelian gauge theories allowed the development of quantum chromodynamics. This actually came after the development of the electroweak standard model, which is a more complicated gauge theory. QCD is simpler in some sense. It actually came a couple of years later, but it's much easier to start with. So in QCD, the basic ingredients are quarks and these come in six types of quarks: up, down, charm, strange, top, and bottom. And the Q, the electric charge of the up, charm, and top, is plus 2/3 in units of E. And for the other three, it's minus 1/3. Of course, when you're just talking about strong interactions, these are just labels. We have this really is only meaningful when you talk about electromagnetism, but still, it's useful to keep that in mind. These are called the six flavors, and we've seen that there are approximate flavor symmetries involving isospin rotations of ups and down, or SU3, up, down, and strange, and you can generalize that to the other quarks. However, the other quarks are so heavy that the breaking from the masses is so large that it's not very useful to extend the flavor symmetries. And sometimes I will write them this way, or sometimes I will write them as Q sub R. R equals just summing over these, or numerically 1 to 6. Now, each actually comes in three colors each. There are actually three of each of these. There's another quantum number, alpha, where alpha runs from 1 to 2, 3, or red, green, and blue. And color or chromo just is an extension of electrodynamics. The color red, green, or blue, it's just a label. It has nothing whatsoever to do with optical colors. It's purely a convenient label. Not everybody even picks the same set of colors when they do this. But I'll usually use an alpha, a Greek letter, to denote the three colors. And I'll use both this notation or QR alpha if I'm trying to label both the flavor and color, or et cetera. In addition, there are gluons. There's going to be an SU3 gauge symmetry acting on this color index. And each flavor, say the U alpha, will be each QR is an irrep, a three-dimensional representation of this group. And there's six of them. And so it's actually highly reducible. There's six color fundamentals. And there are eight gluons, GI, mu, I equals 1 through 8, which are the gauge fields, the things I called A generally, but they're usually called G in this context. And there's a gauge coupling. And I'll also introduce alpha s gs squared over 4 pi. And I will introduce field strength, g mu nu I, which is d mu g nu I minus d nu g mu I minus g sub s times the structure constants for SU3, Fijk, gj mu, gk nu. So those are the basic ingredients. The Lagrangian for QCD, Lagrangian density, is minus a quarter g mu nu I g mu nu I. So that's the gauge part, including the 3 and 4 point gluon self interactions. And then there will be plus the sum r equals 1 to 6 of q bar r I d slash minus mr qr. And that's it. Where d slash, well, but let me just write this out in more detail. This is equal to sum r equals 1 to 6 q bar r I d slash minus g sub s l I G I slash Q and minus M R Q R, where L I is lambda I over 2 is the fundamental SU3 representation. And if you, so I've been written explicitly the Flaber index here. And the SU3 index is, you know, hidden. I could put an alpha, Kronecker delta, alpha beta here, LI alpha beta, QR beta, et cetera, if you wanted. But I've written it in this matrix notation for the SU3 color index. So I have, this is non-chiral. The interaction is the same for left and right. So I have the familiar Feynman rule that you can just read off up there, substituting G for G sub S and LI for just lambda I over 2 gives you the Feynman rule. So that's basically, that is the QCD Lagrangian. And the thing to note is that the M sub R are the so-called bare masses. It's a non-chiral theory, so you can put in bare masses. The and they're completely arbitrary. They're also called current masses to distinguish from some other type of mass. These are not truly bare or elementary mass terms when you consider the full standard model. When you consider the electroweak part of the standard model simultaneously, then these are actually not allowed by the SU2 cross U1 chiral symmetry of the weak interactions. And the masses are actually generated by the Higgs mechanism in the electroweak sector. But when we're just talking about QCD, it suffices to pretend that these are truly bare masses. Yes?
Do the couplings of the quarks have to be the same, or is that just something experimental? Like between all the representations, the gauge coupling for all the representations, like up, down?
Yeah, it's the same for all of them. Yeah, that's experimental. Now, in fact, that was going to be my next statement. The flavor, the interactions are invariant under the SU3 flavor, or SU2 flavor, or even SU6 flavor. The same for all six quarks. Now, I've assumed it. I've assumed that they're all fundamentals and not some other higher dimensional representation of the color group. But assuming that they are all fundamentals, and that's consistent with all kinds of experimental tests, that means that the Flaber symmetry, let's just consider SU2 or SU3, the ones I talked about last week, isospin or the eightfold way, the interactions couldn't care less which flavor it is. They're diagonal in flavor. The interactions always will take an up quark into an up quark, for example, never mixing flavors, never an up into a charm. And the interactions are flavor invariant. However, the mass terms can break the SU2 symmetry, and they can break the SU3 symmetry, and they can break the SU4, SU5, or SU6 flavor symmetry. And I didn't make a big deal out of it, but when I was talking about SU2 and SU3 last week, I did say several times that it seemed in nature that the interactions had a much higher degree of isospin symmetry and SU3 symmetry than the masses. And that's built into QCD automatically. Yes? Yes. In particular, if you went to the limit mu equals md equals zero, which is actually very close to what's observed, then just the Flaber symmetry would be actually a chiral SU2. This is times a, that would become an isospin, but promoted to be a chiral symmetry. This is flavor. No. And then there would be a U1 associated with baryon number, because each quark carries a baryon number of 1/3, and that's clearly conserved here. There's actually another U1 called axial baryon number that's also perturbatively conserved. That's basically the chiral extension of this, but this one is broken by non-perturbative effects. I don't want to go into that. So that's the Flaber symmetry, plus we have the SU3 color symmetry. One can then calculate processes involving quarks and gluons perturbatively, assuming that G sub S is small enough, and I'll talk about that tomorrow. The G sub S, I haven't written down a value for it because it really depends on the momentum carried by a gluon line. But the and I will talk a little about things like confinement and evidence for color and all that tomorrow. But let me, as the last thing today, towards the end today, let me just talk about simple processes. So one can calculate in this theory processes like, let's consider And this one will be relevant to your tutorial. So I like to at least write the diagrams. So QR beta, anti-QR alpha can scatter into QS gamma Q bar S delta, where beta, alpha, gamma, and delta are the color indices, and R and S are Flaber indices. I've taken the same Flaber here and here, same Flaber here and here. Now, in the real world, one, it's usually convenient to average over colors, just like one does over spins if you don't measure them. But for now, let's just consider this as a process. So this would be the process. Now there is, since I have assumed that the two Flabers are the same here, and a gluon vertex conserves Flaber, there is always, I'm going to write the Feynman diagrams at tree level, there's always a diagram that looks like this. It's conventional to denote gluons by wavy lines, or, you know, lines like that, rather than, that's the sort of generic symbol for a spin one gauge boson. But for gluons, one usually uses these wavy lines, which is a real pain because it's hard to construct these in any nice computer program for Feynman diagrams. But anyway, this diagram is always present, where this is a gluon. And here, if this is gauge boson K, and if this is Lorentz index mu at this end, and this would be I, and nu would be the indices associated with the vertices, then this diagram is always present. And for R not equals S, this is the only diagram. So for example, it could be U bar goes to D D bar. In that case, this is the only diagram. And if you write out the actual scattering amplitude corresponding to this, this is initial, this is final, well, you have to follow each fermion line. So let me call this also P3, P4, P1, and P2 are the physical four momenta of the fermions coming in or going out of the diagram. So this becomes, well, I have a vertex minus I, G sub S, doing this vertex. Then there's a U bar 3, gamma mu. There's an LK alpha, LK gamma delta times V spinner for 4. And the spins, ordinary spins, are hidden in these spinners also. I'm not going to write them. So that's the upper fermion line. Then we have a gluon propagator, which is minus I G mu nu times Kronecker delta I K over Q squared, where Q is P1 plus P2 is equal to P3 plus P4. system momentum, virtual momentum here. And then the bottom line, which is minus I G sub S times V bar 2, there's a gamma nu. There's an L I alpha beta, and there is a U 1. And I would say with 50% confidence level, I didn't make any mistakes there, which means at 50% confidence level, I messed up one of the indices or one of the signs, but that's the idea. So one can then calculate with this. You have to take into account the spinners, like you did for electrodynamics, and you have to take into account these color factors. In the exercises, you will be asked to do a color average in which you sum over all the final colors and average over all the initial colors, just like one often does for spin. And then one will can also have the case R not equal to S. And if R is not equal to S, then there would be, in that case, I've run out of time, so I have to. In that case, if R is equal to S, there's another diagram exchanging the gluon in the T channel. There's always a relative minus sign because they're fermions. Okay, are there any questions? So that is the basic structure of QCD. Tomorrow I will continue here. I'll actually talk about some of the experimental evidence for color, for gluons, and for QCD and the interactions. And I'll say something about the short and long distance regimes, the fact that at high energies, G sub S is small, and at the effect of G sub S at low energies is large. I'll discuss those qualitative features and a little about the renormalization group running of the G sub S. So I'll see you on that tomorrow.